Having offices almost on every continent, and having salespeople that are out there talking to clients just makes a big difference. You know, I think we've kind of bridged COVID by having all of these virtual get-togethers, but I really am a big believer in the company is too that when you get out and speak to people, when you go to their parks and you see what they think and what their guests think, it makes a huge difference. You know, the amount of information that we can learn just by visiting, you know, a big park like a Six Flags property or a family-owned park by Knoebels, and just hearing them say, you know, this is really working well for us, you know, this is really not, that makes a big difference.
Welcome to the Attraction Pros Podcast, where we discuss the latest trends and challenges facing the attractions industry today.
We chat with some of the top leaders in the field and provide resources that will help develop your career in this great industry.
I am Josh Liebman. I am obsessed with the guest experience and helping attractions make that their top priority for success.
And I'm Matt Heller. I am passionate about organizational effectiveness, leadership development, and employee engagement.
Now sit upright, hold on tight, and get ready for the Attraction Pros Podcast.
Hey, Josh, how are you?
Hey, Matt, I am fin. No, I'm just kidding.
You could do it.
I won't do it. No. It's not my place. I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Today, I have a question for you.
All right.
With all the different positions and jobs that you've had over the years, what's been your favorite title?
My favorite title. I don't know. They've all been pretty normal titles.
Okay.
I can't really think of anyone that stands out nearly as exciting as our guest today, which I assume is probably why you might be asking.
That's exactly why I asked, because our guest today has actually the word roller coaster in his title.
First of all, I'm super jealous of Adam Sandy, who is the roller coaster sales and marketing director for Zamperla, one of the most prominent ride manufacturers in the world. Been around for now 55 years, as Adam will tell us. And Adam recently took on this position to really help Zamperla achieve a lot of very ambitious goals of releasing new ride concepts and new designs and filling some gaps in the industry when it comes to ride designs and rides that are available in the portfolio of multiple manufacturers. And it's going to be really cool to learn about all of that.
It is. And I think what's also going to be cool is we're going to talk to Adam about not just Zamperla, but kind of how he goes about his sales process. And it's not the kind of used car salesman, you know, that kind of thing that finger guns, if you're listening and not watching. It's not that kind of thing, but he really taps into his passion for the industry that started very, very young, you know, in his family, and talks about the connection to his parents and grandparents in terms of, you know, people that are, you know, in and experiencing the industry, and how that has really fueled his passion. And that really helps his sales process.
Yeah. And I got to say, for anyone out there who's maybe in a sales role or intrigued about it, or just wants to know about the overall process, connecting the dots here as far as what Adam has to say about how he takes his sales approach to what he's selling. Like, I cannot think of all that many more big ticket items than, you know, a $10 million roller coaster. So it's pretty important that he's got the sales foundation, and, you know, he doesn't sound like a sales guy. Like you said, that, you know, that whole kind of used car mentality of it. He's just one of the most genuine and one of the most nice people out there. So I'm really looking forward to chatting with him today.
Well, I am too. So should we get to it?
Let's get to this awesome interview with Adam Sandy from Zamperla. Adam Sandy, welcome to the Attraction Pros Podcast. It's so exciting to have you here. How are you?
I'm doing great. How about you?
We're doing awesome. We're really excited to talk all about Zamperla, about roller coaster sales, and really just roller coasters in general. You know, it's a topic I think we all agree is an enjoyable one to talk about. So let's actually start with that. We want to know all about, you know, your current role with Zamperla and everything going on with the company, but let's make sure to talk about you first and just your time in the industry, and particularly why you wanted to be a part of this industry.
Sure. And I'll even kind of take it further than back than that, if that's okay. So like to really throw things back, I did a little show and tell today since we're doing video. So I kind of got started because this is, if you can see, there we go. Yeah. My dad over here and my grandmother, and my dad at Staten Island, my grandmother at Palisades Park, for those of you listening, not on video, just some pictures of relatives. And I think it's a great way to start because I really got my interest in parks. It was this weird thing. I was interested in roller coasters, had no idea why. I was scared to ride roller coasters, so that's even stranger. But I had this really cool connection with my grandmother, my dad's mother. They were from Jersey, and my dad grew up going to Coney Island, so riding the coasters, also going to Palisades and Olympic. And I actually got more show and tell, this book, The Great American Amusement Park by Gary Curiazzi. Came out in the late 70s. Tons and tons and tons of pictures of Coney and old amusement parks. And I think, I don't know about you guys age-wise, but I'm 42. So I'm in this unique space where I'm old enough to remember life without the internet. And it was actually, you know, a decent part of my formative years. So a lot of my interest was time spent going to the library, talking to my grandmother, learning about her time going to Coney Island as a kid. And all of those things just kind of culminated in this interest that just grew in me. I mean, when I was a kid, I had, you know, I owe my church a lot of money growing up because I would take that book and photocopy it and put the pictures up on the walls. So that was my room. It was like Rush albums and roller coaster pictures. So not great for the ladies, but it was a really fun place to grow up. So I kind of just had this weird passion. And I just said, I want to turn that into a job. And then in 2001, I got a job with Amusement Business, which was a attractions industry news weekly. And that was 1 week before 9/11. So not the best time to enter the industry, but I was just happy to have a job and get paid to go to IAPA. It was kind of like, what more could I ask for?
Well, now, Adam, we may have to take this on a couple of different rabbit trails. I'm a huge Rush fan, as you know. We've talked about that on Twitter.
Yes, yes. Before,
so we may have to venture off that way a little bit. But, you know, I'm curious when you say that that was not a great time to get into the industry right around you know, September 11th. So what happened from there? Like, how did you go from not being a great time to, you know, being the roller coaster sales guy?
Yeah, it obviously our industry took and travel in general took an understandably big hit at that time. And really, when I came to the newspaper, it had lost a lot of advertising with Amusement Today and then Fun World, you know, starting up. And it lost especially a lot of water park and roller coaster manufacturers. And they really just brought me in and said, we've lost this book of business. What do you think you can do? And I've never really sold anything before. I'm a history major. Don't consider myself a salesman, but I'll give it a try. And I kind of spoke their language and was able to reach out to those specific groups and bring them back to the magazine. And they actually were there several years essentially until I left. So it just happened to work out really, really well timing wise.
When you said you spoke their language, was it the language of roller coasters and rides and manufacturing? Was it the language of sales, or was it kind of a fusion of those in between that allowed you to, I would say, develop those relationships?
The way I found, you know, the ability to do sales and the ability to connect with people is really just using my nerdy knowledge. So I'd reach out to the companies and could just speak their language about their rides, their attractions, their goals, and really knew what was going on. Again, we were kind of more early internet stages, I like to call it. So it's not like information was prevalent everywhere. So I still knew, you know, at their core, a lot more about their business than they expected a guy who sold for a newspaper to. And so I would just use that knowledge base to talk to them and see how could I work with them to grow their business as a client.
So for anybody listening who is not of our age and understands what things were like pre-internet, where did you get all that? You said you did all those copies at your church, but where were you getting all of your information?
Yeah, it was a combination. It was books. It was American Coaster Enthusiast, their magazine. It was certainly early internet. Like I remember distinctly a vision I have is when Holiday World put a POV video of the Raven up online. Like it was a QuickTime link. It was terrible resolution, but it was still really cool to see. I think that was like 96 or 97. They put it up. And that was kind of game changing where you were starting to get the, you know, these small bits of information out there. And then it wasn't all text, you know, you started adding pictures, you started adding video. And so it was just kind of everything that I'd had, but certainly, yeah, I read like the Gary Curiazzi book or There's a great Rick Burns documentary that came out, I think, 89 about Coney Island that kind of told the island's history up to then. So I watched those things over and over just because it fascinated me. I love the idea of things like Steeplechase Park, that it just seemed so almost otherworldly to me, or the idea of Luna Park at night and, you know, like in 1903, 1904, when people never seen electricity, and the stories that were told about people stopping on the boardwalk and just staring as the park lit up. Like, for whatever reason, those stories just grit me and really pulled me in to just want to learn more.
Adam, how do you explain this passion to people who aren't in the industry or aren't enthusiasts about it? Because that's a challenge that I feel like I have always had as far as being able to explain why this is so important and why this is so cool. And have you encountered that as well? And how do you deal with that?
Yeah, I think I kind of relate it to, there's so many people, especially in the US, who are big sports fans. Yeah. And it's like, I understand sports. I certainly enjoy baseball and hockey, but I'm not a passionate sports fan. But there are some people that live and die by it. You know, I mean, every Sunday they're watching their football game. And I tend to draw that analogy. It's, I feel that the way about amusement parks or roller coasters, that those people feel about their specific football team and if they make it to the Super Bowl. So I think that's the easiest way of kind of found to explain this to people who would just give me a puzzled look when I say, I really like riding roller coasters. Yeah.
I've definitely felt that as well, and trying to explain that a little bit. And, you know, you get to a point where it's like, well, you know I like to ride roller coasters. That's probably enough. Like, I don't need to tell them about the horses and, you know, what it feels like when you come to the brake run and all that kind of stuff and the Zen ride. They don't need to know about that stuff. But I do want to make sure, of course, that we talk a little bit more about Zamperla. So it's a very well-known name in the industry. You know, certainly you go to IAPA and you can see a lot of different stuff about Zamperla. But can you give us kind of your idea of their history and give us a little bit of your background now that you're in the company?
Sure. You're giving me a challenge here as I'm still the new guy. I just started January. So here's my kind of my understanding of the company history. So it was started by Antonio Zamperla, and we're actually going to be celebrating our 55th anniversary. But when the company was young, you know, and Antonio, as I understand it, was very much hands-on mechanical guy. Like that's how the company grew under him as the first generation owner. And really it was creating small family attractions that, you know, they could sell throughout Europe, specifically in Italy. And then when Alberto took over, he was much more of a salesperson. He's not really mechanically based, certainly has a good knowledge base, but he was great at sales and he really worked to grow the company. So they grew it. He came over and worked to open the North American office, which opened a huge new market to them. And then really a big turning point in the company's history as they kind of grew and grew was Disneyland Paris in the early 90s. And Disney came to the company and said, we've heard a bunch of great things about you. We loved your kind of combination of amazing theming capabilities with really good mechanical skills. And we want to see how we could work together. And I believe it was 8 attractions from Zamperla open with the property. And for Zamperla as a whole, that was game changing, because all of a sudden the clients who we'd gone out to and spoken to said, well, we're not sure if we want to work with Zamperla. You're in Italy. What about spare parts? All those typical refusals you hear when you're entering a new market, really those don't apply anymore. Because if Disney is buying 8 rides from you, it's like, well, we got to consider you now. And then the company really worked to develop things that were at all price points. So things that the Disney Universals of the world were interested in, but also the things that at the time when the carnival market was big and small parks could afford. So working to just hit every buyer demographic was really important to the company's success.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. So then flash forward to today, and you are now the roller coaster sales and marketing director. Tell us a little bit about your position and what you're overseeing now.
It's super exciting. I gotta say that. I never kind of in all my years imagined I'd be the roller coaster sales guy, but here I am. So that's pretty great that I get to, you know, wake up and do this day in, day out. But the company as a whole, you know, we've really changed our market position in the last decade. So people knew us really as Family Ride Company, you know, starting even 20, 25 years ago. It transitioned to a point where people would come to Zamperla and they would say, we want to get this basket of attractions from you, because we were known as that family ride manufacturer. In the last decade, we've added really thrill rides to that. So Six Flags, Cedar Fairs, companies as Alps, other ones will come to us and say, you're one of a handful of contenders for this big thrill ride that we want to put in. But with our coasters, our history was really, we did them to kind of augment, you know, our flat ride offerings. They were never the star, they were part of the bigger picture. And really the company in the last couple of years has said, we want to be a player on the same stage as those, you know, mid-level and big tier coaster manufacturers. And so they spent a lot of time and money investing in engineering, personnel, and quality assurance to bring the product line up. And now, like this year, we're going to be introducing, I think it's 9 or 10 rides in 2021. And three of those are going to be kind of new to market concepts from Zamperla. You know, really, we want to be an innovator, not a duplicator in the space. So we're coming out with product that no one, in a lot of cases, no one has ever seen before.
And that's really hard because there's a lot of things that are already out there, right? And you do see a lot of duplication, right? So I'm curious, we had a gentleman on a couple of episodes ago, we talked a lot about innovation. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious about, you know, what you can share with us about the innovation process at Zamperla to find those things that are so unique that you wouldn't see anyplace else.
I think a big part of that is that we're a very sales centric company. I mean, we sell like 150 to 200 rides a year of all sizes, which in our industry is huge. And because we've got offices all over the world, we have team members that go out and talk to clients a lot. And what we do is we bring that feedback back to our team. So we have an innovation and prototyping team. We have an engineering team, and we all get together and really bring these ideas that clients, you know, tell us, not necessarily for what the ride can do, but much more, we learn from our clients, budget, capacity, marketability, rider demographic, because, you know, certainly you have those things that different groups that are kind of evergreen, but we really see trends where in summer right now, the biggest trend, you know, we're introducing our tweener rides is because you've got a ton of family rides, you've got a ton of thrill rides, but we were hearing from our clients that there was this hole in the marketplace for that 42-inch height requirement attraction. And that was for a number of reasons. One, we're seeing younger kids who are willing to do more exciting things at a younger age. That has changed, especially in the North American market. That also pairs with, you have attractions that have been around a long time, like the Eli Bridge Scrambler, where maybe when they came out, they had a 36-inch height requirement. Because of code changes and other things, that could be 42 today. So we're seeing those rides that maybe occupied that middle space at amusement parks that have been around a long time, like a Lake Compound or a Cedar Point, all of a sudden those have been bumped up. So they're less accessible to younger riders and don't provide that bridge to thrills anymore. And we're really coming into that space. And now Zamperla has this prototyping and concept team that comes up with these crazy ideas and says, we can not only make it great, but we can make it really hit those, like these new rides are 42 inches, like the Nebules is a great example. Really marketable ride, really fun to watch, really fun to ride, and it's 42 inches to get on. So you're hitting a wide range of ridership.
I think this is so interesting, just from a product development standpoint, and curious if we can expand a little bit more on that or go a little bit deeper mm-hmm. into how it's determined, where is this gap in the marketplace? You mentioned the Scrambler that was maybe 36-inch height requirement many years ago when it came out. Now it's bumped up a little bit, which I guess alienates some of what would have been previous ridership. How is this intelligence gathered as far as being able to determine, okay, we have a gap that we need to fill and we need to create this ride concept that can now serve this demographic that isn't being served as much, or this height demographic, and probably for the most part, isn't being served as well as it could be?
Honestly, that's really simple. It's boots on the ground. Having offices almost on every continent and having salespeople that are out there talking to clients just makes a big difference. You know, I think we've kind of bridged COVID by having all of these virtual get-togethers, but I really am a big believer in the company is too, that when you get out and speak to people, when you go to their parks and you see what they think and what their guests think, it makes a huge difference. You know, the amount of information that we can learn just by visiting, you know, a big park like a Six Flags property or a family-owned park by Knoebels and just hearing them say, you know, this is really working well for us, you know, this is really not, that makes a big difference. And our team really takes time to visit the park, talk to ownership and understand what they're going through, but also just walk the park. It kind of amazes me. And again, just age-wise, I came in where I was kind of the youngest salesperson for a long time in this industry. It was traditionally much older, kind of, you know, old relationships, good old boy network. And that was great for that age. But the interesting thing about a lot of those old sales guys was they didn't ride anything. They go, they'd have a drink with somebody, you know, coffee in the morning, beer in the afternoon, say hi, say here are our new rides, and then they'd leave. You know, when I go to a park, I go have generally a morning meeting. We talk about new product. We talk about any product they have from us that might not be working as well as it should be, make sure they're a satisfied client from their existing portfolio. And then I go spend time on the property. If I can walk the park with the GM, that's great because I kind of get their insights and better understand what they see in the park and how it could grow. But also I spend time on my own. You know, I like to see, you know, what simple things, what refreshment stands are doing well, what things are doing well from a per cap perspective because they're placed where they are, you know, because they're near a new successful ride or because they're out, you know, on their own, but they have a great product. You know, it's really our job to gather all that information sort of with our eyes and ears just to understand who our competitors are, but also understand what the marketplace looks like because it certainly shifts every few years.
Well, and it's sort of that holistic view, right, of how the entire operation works. So, yes, I could put a Zamperla ride right here, but it's all the other things around it that makes it successful as well. And how much do you think that comes from your background, you know, showing us those pictures of your grandmother and your father? How much of it comes from there and the passion that you already have inside of you versus someone who comes on the scene and is more of a quote-unquote salesperson?
I think for me personally, it certainly comes from the passion side. But one of the reasons I joined the company is because the attitude is very much talk to the client. Like even though some of the other people I have on our team, like, you know, Ramon on our team always says he has vertigo and Michael enjoys rides, but, you know, he's not a hardcore rides guy like I am. But the commonality between all of us is that we go out and see our clients, visit them, and walk the properties. You know, we want to understand their business because we view it as their success is our success. And if we come to them with an attraction that really doesn't fit, it doesn't make sense. So even though we've got over 90 products in the portfolio, when we do a presentation, it's very targeted. It's a handful of attractions, either from a coaster perspective or a hard ride perspective that we think are going to make them successful. It's not, this is my new expensive ride, you should buy it. It's, we think that what you're missing is this. And here are three different rides at three different price points. They're going to kind of feed your demographic and make your park more successful.
I think that's so interesting. And I would love to even talk more about the sales process when it comes to such a large investment, a huge, you know, CapEx, price tag that comes with a continual reinvestment that a park needs to do to keep it fresh and to keep people coming back. So can you actually just walk us through roller coaster sales 101? You get the first meeting, kind of how does it differ than, I don't know, software sales or someone who's selling something that might not be as expensive as a roller coaster or a large attraction?
Sure. For me, I really break it down really simply. I call it ABC. It's audience, budget, capacity. Like those are my three things that when I talk to a client, if I know that, it takes me in a lot of different directions. But if I can talk to, you know, who they want to serve in the audience, what's their budget, and what hourly capacity do they need for that demographic, I can provide a lot of good answers to them. Because it doesn't do me any good to go and say, here's my new 10 million euro coaster, when they really need to fulfill, you know, their 36 inch height requirement for kids. Mm-hmm. So it's really talking to a client, finding out what's the most important to them, and then saying, this is what fits on the coaster side. And then we can go a lot of different directions. We can certainly look at things that are, you know, maybe a step out thrill-wise, or we can do a bigger investment like we did Fire Chaser Express when I was with Ride Entertainment at Dollywood, and that fit them because they, when we went, they had this huge gap. They had I think at the time it was an L&T coaster, then they went up to the GCI coaster at 48 inches. They had nothing in there, and that opened at 39 inches. And that's become the second most popular ride at the park. And so we really work with the clients to understand, you know, what are their needs, and then explore the many different permutations of what we can produce that fulfill that need.
Well, and it sounds like your ABCs are another way to speak that client's language, right? So you mentioned that earlier when you were talking about AB, and now I think we're hearing that that trend continue. So when people are either selling a product or selling themselves, how important is it that they speak other people's language, not just their own?
Yeah, I think it's a good point. I think it's extremely important. For me, it's just always more a, I guess I find the part is I like parks. So I like hearing when a park owner or the park president or even a family member says, this is working, this isn't, this is our challenge. And I enjoy sitting down and having that conversation because it, as a salesperson, it educates me a lot on what their needs are. But it also offers that opportunity of a connection that, again, you know, like I said, I'm not necessarily that instant connection used to car salesman personality, but I can connect on them with a level and they can say, we're having problems with this ride. And I can say, well, that makes sense. I talked to another client. They were having some issues with that. You should talk to this company. I know they do repairs on that kind of ride, even though the manufacturer is not around. So that's just an example of how I try and translate that knowledge into maybe something that not only shares a commonality with them, but I can help them solve some problems along the way.
Yeah.
And it also just really shows your proficiency and your commitment, not just to the success of your own sales, but also just to the client and to the industry in general. So I appreciate you sharing that. What is the math look like for determining what the budget should be like for a roller coaster or for, you know, such a large investment like this? And part of the reason why I ask this is because when you break it down, the ride itself that they would be purchasing from Zamperla is probably, you know, the lion's share, but not the entire budget for what they're investing in. When you talk about kind of what's around that attraction, you say, okay, well, here's the ride. Now we need a bathroom. We need retail. We need a food venue next to it. We need all this concrete and landscaping and paint and, you know, into all of that. And so it goes beyond the, you know, the revenue that the coaster manufacturer is actually getting. But how is it determined, you know, once they determine the need, okay, we need a 36-inch height requirement, how is that then calculated as far as what's the ideal spend to then invest in?
I think there's no official answer to that. I think my unofficial answer is really is what is it, you know, what need is it serving? Are you really getting people, you know, more bodies on the ride, or are you using it as a marketable piece? An example I give, a good one is a log flume. So that particular ride, if you put a new one in, it is very unsexy. You know, they've been around since the 60s. It's not a big deal. The practicality of putting a log flume in is it's probably the most popular ride in the park at most properties when you put one in, whether it's old or new, because a lot of them are 36 or 42 inches to ride. It's going to be immensely popular. The on-ride photo on that sales are going to be huge. And it's just kind of an evergreen attraction that works really well. So rides like that, you're not necessarily going to get a lot of buzz if you put it on social media or
unless
billboard.
It makes its way into an SNL sketch. Sorry.
Unless it's hashtag Viking Voyager. Yes. So if it gets there, it's great, but just it's not something that's going to necessarily drive the gate, but from a guest satisfaction standpoint, it's huge. And there are going to be other projects, like I mentioned, Fire Chaser. The goal there was to do something that hit a certain demographic, but also had marketable attributes where we had the forward and backwards launch on it. So there, the marketability was as important as the ride experience. The marketability got people through the gate, having good time with your family, ensured they returned.
One thing I'm curious about, Adam, when you are embarking on the sales process, and this may be different for different companies, but obviously you're working with people like well, I shouldn't say obviously, I'm guessing, but you're working with the maintenance team to figure out, you know, where it needs to go and how it needs to be put up. Are we also working with the operational team, like even in those early stages, to figure out where people need to be and how the ride's going to actually be operated in that location? Like, does it get down to that granular process in the beginning, or is that kind of brought in later?
Yeah, as an operations guy, I'm sure you'd love to hear that we take those thoughts into consideration very early. And no, usually those are much later.
It's been nice talking to you, Adam.
Yes. and a lot of that is just because a lot of the costs you don't see, power, infrastructure being some of them, dictate sometimes where these things can go. So it may not be ideal from a operations perspective or from, you know, the human factor, but we've put a ton of money in the ground there, or we've had log flume, great example, like at Adventureland, they had a log flume in that spot where we put a coaster. They took it out, but log flume requires a ton of power and a ton of space. So it was a natural spot to put a coaster. So we put it there and then had to work the logistics afterwards. So unfortunately, the ops people are often last to have a voice in where something may go or how it may be built. And even some things like the station, you know, certainly those are always tricky because on the CapEx side, you want to keep it as small as possible. But for the operators, you want to make it as big as possible. So that's always, you know, another just practical business fight that, you know, people wrestle with.
Yeah. And then there's theming on top of that, right? You just have a wooden structure as a station, you know, have a nice cover over it and things like that. But, you know, then if you bring into a theme and all the way through the queue and through the ride vehicle, and then it gets a lot more crazy.
Yeah. And then you add your own challenges too. You know, the more theming you add to the station, the more operational, you know, interferences you might have. So everything kind of has to be a symphony of sorts when it all works together. And that's why I think the best projects I've been on are ones that really find the creative team, talking the engineering team, talking the ops team and the maintenance team, because it all has to work together for it to be a successful attraction long-term.
Well, then in that case, how much collaboration is there with the manufacturers that do focus on the operators? So for instance, a few months ago, we were chatting with Linda Freeman from Rockwell Automation. We were talking about Allen Bradley panels and things like that. So are those conversations early on as well, or are those separate conversation that the parks are having with manufacturers and the engineering component of it?
Yeah, we tend to have those pretty early on because we will get a lot of the things that your operators, your hourly employees interface with on a regular basis. You know, there's certainly been a lot of work over the last 20 years to standardize those. You know, I think control panels are an obvious example. So we'll get a lot of requirements and thoughts from the park on how, on what specific ones to supply, because a lot of times, you know, if it's a park, they'd like that one panel on all or a lot of their rides, or if it's a chain, they'd like that throughout the chain if possible. So those things are spec'd out pretty early on. It's the things that kind of come later are station design, queue layout, where you're going to put the gates to get on the train. Those kind of specific operational things are often done much later, more as the architecture for the station is worked on.
So I'm curious, Adam, you've been talking about rides and roller coasters and things. Are there things that are either in the portfolio or things that you just know of that they look really cool, but they're even for you, they're just not your cup of tea?
Not really. I have pretty much ride everything.
Awesome. Awesome.
So what about design, fabrication, quality assurance, and that entire approach to coasters? Can you talk a little bit about how that has changed and evolved and been updated just over the years?
Sure. No, I mean, I can say just kind of generally speaking for our industry, you know, if you went back to the Schwarzkopf and Aero days, it was really hand bending pipe to make, you know, for Aero, the two pipe track. And then Schwarzkopf had a similar but different setup, but it was, you know, very much hand and some hand measurements. You might take like coordinates every meter or so. And that's really changed to, you know, now at Zamperla, we're using lasers to measure all of our track sections. So we'll see the two rails and how they're, if they're offset at all. And then once welding's done and it's cooled, if they've changed their shape at all, because, you know, obviously steel will change a bit when it cools down. And so we've really changed the process from, you know, in the 1960s, it was really let's put it together and have it run. And now it's very much a high-tech engineering operation where it's, you know, the science is there as much in the fabrication part of it as in the engineering part.
I've got to imagine that from the fabrication standpoint, you got to be pretty precise. Like if ever I'm watching kind of like a construction update of a coaster that's being built and it gets to the point where they're adding in the last piece, I'm always sitting there going, I hope it fits. Like it better inch off. Right?
It's always a harrowing time for sure. For sure. Cause you got the fabrication, like in that situation, you got the fabrication element, but also foundation. So someone had to go in and shoot the foundations with surveys, then pour concrete, and then hope all of that lines up in addition to whatever your earth conditions are. There are just so many factors, and the fact that our industry gets it right so often is really amazing to me.
And so when we're thinking about engineering, you have to be thinking about guest comfort on that attraction, right? And the whole experience. Mm-hmm. So kind of where does that play into that experience, and how do you, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of experience that goes into this, but how do you determine if you're creating a brand new attraction that's never been done before? How do you know how that's going to affect someone's body?
Yeah, I think there are two parts to it. I'd say the engineering side is certainly looking at the, you know, just the practical dynamics of the ride and what you think it'll do. So that's it's not easy, but it's certainly something you can calculate. The other big part from a guest comfort perspective is really like seat and restraint. And that we've certainly taken a lot of time to look at that and say, how do we make something that on the one hand is very manageable from a maintenance standpoint? Because you want something where they can get to it easily. You know, you can service the hydraulic cylinders and get to those without taking the whole freaking thing apart, but that it's also really comfortable for the guests to sit in. Like that's a really big engineering challenge. And I think our industry is so different compared to many others because so many operate without the general public interfacing with machinery. And we literally work on attractions that, you know, you're moving vehicles that weigh like a Mack truck does, you know, in and out of the station every few minutes. And I don't think people really understand sometimes the complexities of what we do. And then you add in the human element, and we not only have to have it safe for people off board, we have to create experiences that are safe for them to ride. And I'm kind of in awe of just what our controls engineers and what the ride designers can do to create these huge machines that are infinitely complicated and have them be as safe as they are.
Yeah. So in terms of coaster concepts coming in the future, obviously, I'm sure there's probably a lot that you can't talk about, but would love to know what you can talk about in terms of what we can start to get excited about.
Unfortunately, all I can give you is a teaser at this point. So I can say, you know, as we mentioned, we've really rethought what Zamperla can bring to the roller coaster world. And with that, this year, we're saying we think in general, the industry is going to have a huge bounce back. I know we don't know, is that going to be this spring, this summer, or even early next year, but we just have seen this amazing pent-up demand because of what life has been like for the last year. So we're very comfortable the industry is going to come back extremely strong. And that's why Zamperla, I think we're doing 9 or 10. I can never remember the number. It seems to change every day. But we're introducing a ride basically every month until IAAPA this year. And we're going to roll those out through our social media platforms. You know, traditionally, we do that at the trade shows because you could come see it, touch it, ride it. And we said, well, we want to just showcase our innovation. We want to show that Zamperla is not thinking about where we are, but where we think our industry is going to be. And we're going to do that via, you know, our online portal. So each month we're showcasing these new attractions, and through those will be coasters. They're going to be coasters that we've never really done before that are new concepts to us, and many of them new concepts to the industry. And just, we want to show what we can do, you know, through those announcements. So, you know, if you follow all of our channels or at Zamperla Rides, you can follow those and you'll see, you know, these new and innovative ways we're going to be announcing product. And we're going to be bringing on some special guests to talk about that product also. So really trying to bring, you know, a different media approach to ride announcement than we've done in the past. IAAPA is great and it's awesome, but it's also crowded and busy. So I really think that this opportunity where we can talk about each ride and educate buyers ahead of time and fans too. And then when they come to the show in Orlando, they really know more about what we're talking about. And from a buyer perspective, we can have really serious conversations about product where we're not talking about introducing it to them, but talking about things at a granular level.
Yeah, you're not unveiling it at IAAPA. There should already be some thought around that, or some education around that, which is great.
Yeah, and our hope is we're going to excite people about some attractions and they can come ride them at the show, because we're going to have 3 or 4 on the show floor this year.
Awesome. Well, speaking about excitement and nerdiness, let's dive into a little bit of Adam's favorites. So can you share with us a little bit of your favorite roller coasters, attractions, rides, just kind of give us your top, if you will, top couple things.
Sure. A couple favorites. I mean, just off the cuff, I'd say, you know, I love Phoenix at Knoebels. It's kind of just classic wooden coaster. Love Raven at Holiday World. I just think that's such a unique, one-of-a-kind ride. For dark rides and other attractions, I think Gronelund is one of the most unique park experiences I had. If you want to just go bigger picture, just I love how they've stacked everything on top of each other there. You know, now they're somehow wedging in a B&M kind of in between everything they have. So I think that's really exciting. And I just want to go back there and visit again. I haven't been there since 2009. And so I like visiting parks like that because they're unique. Mm-hmm. And I find I learn a lot of things when you see people problem solving with their ride installations. It lets you learn a lot as a salesperson. And then I guess another favorite would be Revolution at Magic Mountain and Shockwave at Over Texas, kind of those were just rides that, you know, I heard about as a kid. I had this VHS tape called America Screams that I watched with that Vincent Price hosts, which it's, you can't get more 70s than that. It's fantastic. It's bell bottoms, it's disco music, it's wonderful. But those are just, you know, rides I heard a ton about as a kid because I was like 6-7 years old and they were still pretty big deals at that age. So those are just some of my kind of classic favorites, I'd say, from a steel coaster perspective.
Awesome.
That's awesome. So I want to tie this together here. A little bit ago, you talked about the importance of that boots on the ground and that importance of walking the parks and understanding the client and their needs. What are your boots on the ground like when you are in Adam leisure mode with your family and visiting parks? And do you have an on and off switch for this? Or are you getting inspired? Are you pointing out areas that you think could be improved? Or what's it like when Adam visits a park on his own for fun? Or with your family, I should say.
Yeah, I mean, it's yeah, two different things. So like if I'm with other adults, it's certainly let's go have fun, let's grab a beer, let's do some rides. And certainly I still take a lot in. Going with my kids has been a lot of fun, but it's also taught me a lot. I write some articles just sporadically for Blue Loop. And one of my early ones was called The Kid's Eye View. And I wrote that because I was visiting parks with Anya, who's my oldest. She's 9 now. She, I think, was maybe 4 or 5 at the time. And I found it really interesting because when I visited with her, she caught things I never noticed. And I would see things like signage. Some parks did a really good job of making sure that kids could read it, you know, that it was at a height level or even duplicated. And then some things she totally missed that she should have seen or should have gotten excited about because that signage was 6 feet in the air and she wasn't looking there. She was looking straight ahead. So going with her and my other daughter, Kira, I've really learned a lot about kind of do's and don'ts. You know, how do you speak to that audience? They're not the ones who are practically driving to the park. But let's be honest, with the way some kids are online and where they voice their opinions now, it's different than it was 50 years ago. Kids are decision makers when it comes to, you know, families buying their, you know, I just look at it as families spend entertainment dollars somewhere because it's entertainment dollars, it's entertainment time, and you choose to spend that small amount of items, you know, at a certain park or at a certain movie theater or at a certain ice rink. So what can parks do to make sure they're engaging everybody who walks through the front gate? Because if you're, in my opinion, you really need to work to appeal to kids, parents, and grandparents. And I think a park like Silver Dollar City is really interesting because they do a great job of hitting all three demos. You know, certainly families that are multi-generational are their core audience. So that's who they're speaking to. But I like the fact that some parks really go out of the way to speak to guests that are not 15 to 30. You know, if you hit the lower end and above that, it's really important. And I think that sometimes parks forget whether they're being cutesy with theming or whether they are just trying to look at, look at the audience that brings the best per caps, that whoever spends the money and time to come through their front gate, they're an audience member and should be treated as such. So whether it's signage, whether it's bathroom accessibility, whether it's making sure that you have more women's restrooms than men because they take longer and they shouldn't have to wait, especially since so many women come as mothers and bring their kids to the park. You know, all these things should be taken into consideration when we build a property. Don't just say, we're going to do it the way we've always done things.
Yeah, and I really like that because it really does take into consideration the experience that people are having, not just where we think we should put things, right? Like when you play Roller Coaster Tycoon and you say, well, we need a bathroom here and a bathroom there. You know, we can't design newer parks or redesign areas of parks without really considering the new way that people experience them. And I would imagine that all goes back to what you were talking about earlier with a ride and what's next to it and all the things that are around it. And, you know, you want to make the whole area look good, not just dump it in the middle of an empty parking lot. So, you know, all of that really does take into consideration, at least I would think so from your standpoint.
Oh, it's huge. It's huge. And I think even little things, and I know this has probably been said 10,000 times on this show in particular, but like, little things like cleaning bathrooms. I don't understand why I visit a park or any business. If your bathroom's not clean, I'm not going to eat there. You know, I mean, just little things like that, that I certainly reevaluated when I had kids. You know, the practicalities of how many businesses did I visit that didn't have diaper changing stations in the men's restroom? That perplexes me to no end, because when I go to parks often, I would, you know, because I travel a lot for work, I would take both girls with me so Tomoko could be home, get a break since I've been traveling, and then I go to the restroom and have to like change my kid on the restroom floor. Like that doesn't make sense. And I really think businesses need to just make sure they're understanding who their audience is, and maybe also that their audience right now, like myself, is a different, you know, person who's paying to come through the front gate than there was 20 years ago. My dad might not have changed a diaper at all, but now that's part of my job. So when I go and I have to do it on a dirty bathroom floor, I'm really not a happy guest.
Yeah.
Well, as someone who has already changed, I think, 5 diapers today, I can tell you, I completely agree and very much hope that by the time I take Jacob to a theme park, which hopefully will be soon, that hopefully there are diaper changing stations in the men's room.
Yes.
As we start to kind of wind this down a little bit, if you weren't in this industry, where do you think you'd be? What do you think you'd be doing?
Short answer, I have no idea. I think the easy one is I was a history major in college. I always loved history. It was kind of another passion of mine. So I could certainly see myself teaching or researching or something in that avenue. But I can't give you a great answer because I can't picture myself outside the industry at this point.
It's tough sometimes, right? Especially if you've been in it as long as you have and you have the family connections. It's tough to really think about yourself in a productive way in some other industry. But I have another question that is not related to theme parks specifically, but what's your favorite Rush album?
That's a good question. That's also a very hard question. That's like, choose my favorite kid.
That's the next question. Just
that one might be easier. We could start there. Man,
you can go genres. You can give me a couple of them. You can, you know, it's like kind of choosing wood and steel. You know, there's different.
Yeah, this is true. Yeah, I mean, I'd have to say if you could kind of go by era, probably Hemispheres for the earlier stuff.
Love it.
Moving Pictures. Counterparts was when I was started getting into them, even though it's like later Rush, when I was in early high school, as a young nerd. And then actually their last album, I really, really thought was a fantastic album. So off the top of my head, those would be my top 4.
Yeah, I would agree with all those. I would actually add in 2112. Mm-hmm. Only because, I mean, I think it's a great album musically, but what it did for their career, and this is not Rush prose, I understand, but what it did for their career as they said, hey, we're going to do this our way, and we're going to be true to ourselves. And so for me, that's another reason why I think 2021, at least for me in that conversation.
Yeah, you always like to see people rewarded for taking risks, and it works out. And that's certainly the story of that album.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Didn't Frank Sinatra say he would do it his way, and didn't Styx say they would do it their self? What was it?
do not tarnish our Rush conversation by bringing in Styx.
I just want to be a part of it. I like Rush. I enjoy it when it comes on the radio, but yeah, certainly not to the same level as you. Adam, if people wanted to learn more about Zamperla, if they wanted to get a hold of you directly, if they want to start the process of buying a roller coaster, where would you send them?
If you want a coaster, yeah, just hit me up on Instagram. We'll do a contract in 30 seconds. So a couple places. So Zamperla Rides is kind of our handle for everything. We will be unveiling some new social channels soon, so be sure to subscribe now so you can see our super secret stuff we're coming out with in the next month or so. Personally, feel free to hit me up on LinkedIn. That's where, even though I'm on Facebook and other things, I do a lot of industry stuff there. I kind of nerd out on LinkedIn, just share cool things I found about what we're doing, what the industry is doing there. So, you know, whether you're in the industry or an intern in the industry, want to get into it, I try to just keep myself open to, especially younger people trying to break in. It's a very hard time right now, so I try to make myself available there. If you just like coasters and want to geek out with me over on Instagram at Roller Coaster Sales Guy, I put up a bunch of old random photos and videos and other things just to kind of create conversation. So those are really the best spots.
Adam, I'll just say I love following you on LinkedIn and on Instagram and just seeing all the content that you post. So I appreciate you doing that for the industry. I'll just say that.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. We get to, you know, travel vicariously through you sometimes. So you've been to a lot of places. So Adam, this has been a fantastic conversation. I'm going to call you back so we can talk more about Rush.
Great.
But thank you again for being on the podcast today. And for everybody out there watching and listening, just remember, we are all attraction pros.
Thanks for listening to the Attraction Pros Podcast.
Make sure to subscribe so you can tune in when new episodes release. And even better, please leave us a review on iTunes.
For more information, visit attractionpros.com.